Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. 80 years ago this month, a small, dedicated group of Quakers opened a hostel to provide shelter and a pathway to a new life for refugees who had fled Nazi violence and aggression in Europe. The Scatter Good Friends Hostel in West Branch would end up giving shelter to 185 refugees as it operated from 1939 through 1943. In a few minutes, I'll talk with a woman who lived at the hostel with her family. She arrived when she was only 11 years old. But first, historian Michael Lewick-Trams is here. He is the director of the Traces Center for History and Culture. He's also a guest lecturer at Cornell College. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
All right, so take us back in time. The Scatter Good Friends is a name that many Iowans, of course, are familiar with because of the boarding school in West Branch. And that boarding school has a very long history. But before this hostel opened, the boarding school had closed.
That's right, in 1931 because of the Depression and falling Quaker demographics.
So how did the idea for opening this hostel on those grounds come about?
For me, one of the most exciting aspects of the story, it was a very grassroots project. In the summer of 1938, a group of young Quakers, they would be called Young Friends, had their annual gathering at Clear Lake, by coincidence where I'm from, at the Methodist camp. And as they were talking about the world situation and wringing their hands, this Hitler fellow over in Europe is doing horrible things. We should do something. They had the idea, well, we could do something. And I think the initial concept was, let's bring refugees from the East Coast to Iowa in the summer to this closed school. We could do trips with the refugees. We could do small projects. We could help them integrate, give them language instruction informally and formally. Well, when they sent their letter to the American Friends Service Committee, the AFSC in Philadelphia, their director had just returned from Nazi Europe on a fact-finding delegation. And then in November of 38, there was the Nazi orchestrated pogrom, what some historians call Kristallnacht. And they seized the opportunity, and the AFSC said, no, let's not just have a seasonal project out in the Iowa prairies. Let's bring people there year-round so they can integrate better, and we'll find them jobs away from what was being called the Fourth Reich on the Upper West Side of New York. There were so many European refugees by then that there was actually a backlash. And the East Coast Quakers said, these Iowa Midwest farmer Quakers can help us by literally giving us an escape valve to let some of the pressure off. We want to avoid a resurgence of anti-Semitism, of anti-immigration sentiment. Let's send these people west.
Right. And of course, at this point, when we look back on history, and with all of the knowledge that we have, we do need to recognize that it was very difficult for refugees to get into the United States. And there was a lot of anti-Semitism involved in the policies that kept refugees from getting into the United States and the way that refugees were treated when they got here.
Yes. There have been some very important scholarly research projects undertaken in the last 20, 30 years, and it's been documented. One book, Paper Walls, literally found the paper trail to say that the State Department had an unwritten policy, if you will, it wasn't public, of losing your application. Sorry, you'll have to give us all the new papers again, the affidavits and the documentation of your savings accounts and that you have a sponsor in the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. So they drug their feet, and they this way very effectively kept out maybe hundreds of thousands of people wanted to get out. One thing that I want to mention at this is that there was, on this side of the Atlantic, ambivalence among American Jews. There had already been, for decades, a kind of tension or ambivalence between Germanic Jews and Slavic Jews. And frankly, a lot of American Jews weren't really eager to bring lots of European Jews, especially Eastern European Jews, to this country for fear of rocking the boat. That should be on the record, too.
Who were the young people that wanted to open this hostel? I mean, this was a group of college students. These were very young people who had this idea and carried this out, right?
It was my great privilege as a young doctoral student then in the Humboldt Universität in Berlin in the early 90s. I met 40 of the former refugees and staff. And by then, these kids were elderly people, retired. I visited them in their Quaker retirement apartments in suburban Philadelphia. I met them in Rockford, Illinois. I met them in Ohio. And even as, by then, elderly people, they all had a kind of shining, bright energy. Their memories of what they had experienced, but also just the final result. They produced something unique. It was completely grassroots-driven. There were no government grants. There were not even really government consultations with public authorities how to do a, quote, a better job of integration. This was a homespun project. These young people went on, by and large, to become social workers, activists. I mean, Quakers sort of can't help but not being activists. They were really inspiring, lovely people.
So this is the 80th anniversary this month. Who first came to the hostel? I mean, it was just a few people right at the start, right?
Yes, there were four men. Karl Gamm, who was a homeless Czech. I don't think he was Jewish. He had been studying in Philadelphia, and when the Nazi regime took over the Sudetenland, he was suddenly paperless. He was no longer a Czechoslovak national. He was stuck in Pennsylvania. There was Fritz Troyer, who was a Viennese stationer who had a paper shop back in Vienna. He was living, I think, in Oberlin, Ohio. And there was there were two more men, both Jewish, and the four of them came with a young Quaker, John Kaltenbach, and they came in what was called the Conestoga, literally a panel station wagon, as the old station wagons were, with wooden sides, and they drove, took a couple of days from Pennsylvania out to Iowa. They arrived at a building. They saw in their minds a hostel, but what they saw with their eyes when they pulled up the lane was a building with broken windows and swallow's nests under the eaves and litter and
the school had been closed for 8 years.
Yes, exactly. And they had a lot of work to do. One of the remarkable things about this project is that this was the first time in about 50 years the two branches of Quakerism in Iowa actually talked to each other again. Long story very short, the two main branches of Quakerdom, those that look more like Methodists or Baptists, have pastors and sermons and a little bit of quiet, and then the conservative or unprogrammed Quakers. And they came together for the first time after their great theological split, and the unprogrammed Quakers worked with the AFSC to retrofit the place, and they rented it, I think, for $1 a year to AFSC, whereas the pastoral friends got old sheets and dishes and books and furniture and retrofitted the place. And together, the two groups made it happen.
And what was the idea? How long were guests expected to stay at the hostel when they arrived?
The sojourns varied. Some of the older refugees, especially those who didn't speak English very well, remember French was still the world language. It wasn't yet English. That came after 1945. Many of the older people struggled. The Winklers came to Iowa City, for example, Jakob and Melanie, and they were at the Hillel House. Well, their placement was very problematic. They ended up eventually in Sioux City, which was the Jewish community that produced Abigail and Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren. Who were then called something else.
Dear Abby. And
yeah. So I mean, there are lots of lovely connections here. Anyway, on average, the people came once, but numerous came twice. There are even a couple cases of folks who came a third time. On average, I would say people stayed a month and a half. Some stayed considerably longer. A few stayed for only a couple weeks. This was seen, to be honest, as a last measure. There's a famous story that the Rosenzweigs arrived from Kassel, and they went to a Jewish a building in Manhattan full of Jewish social service organizations, and they went from office to office to office and kept going down the hallway. First one said, "You're too old." They were in their 50s. The next one said, "You have too many children," or the next one said, "You have two children." At the last Jewish agency in the hallway, they said, "Well, we can't help you either. Go to the end of the hall. The Quakers will take you." And indeed, it seems the Quakers were scooping up folks who had no other options, some of whom were political refugees. The famous one, Maria Jukartz, the first woman to address the German parliament, couldn't speak English. She was already around 60 years old. She was in dire straits. There was no Social Security for her. There was no help. She wasn't a Jew, so Jewish agencies wouldn't help her. And finally, sent her to Scattergood. Footnote on her, she, after the war, went back to Germany and was honored today in the German parliament building is at Maria Jukartz Hall.
When the refugees got to the hostel, so the idea was that they would learn the language, they would learn English. What was their programming? What did they do?
One of the great resources in the book that I wrote, Out of Hitler's Reach, was that we got a hold of many of the English class essays. So the refugees were composing essays, which then I assume their American host were editing and helping them improve. And we have great records of their experiences. Also, they wrote about their flight. One Polish Jewish social worker wrote about how she and her small daughter got out of Warsaw during the bombing from the Germans. Others wrote about coming through Bermuda to get to the United States. They couldn't enter right away. They had to go through the Caribbean. So we have these repositories. They also thought that the English acquisition would be casual, while cooking in the kitchen, while doing dishes, while on field trips. The Quakers were quite resourceful. They brought them to Iowa City. They toured the newspaper to see how a paper is written and printed.
They even toured, it wouldn't have been this building back then, but they even toured the university radio station, right?
They did indeed. They went to opera at the University of Iowa. They tried to take the people out to see how life functions here. They had to learn to use pounds and ounces because they were already using metric in Europe. They went to a shop to see how groceries are sold and packaged. They went every Valentine's Day to Amana colonies, where they enjoyed speaking German, although in Platt, with the Amanaites. They tried to bring the people what's called in German hautnah, skin close. Grant Wood, the favorite Iowa painter's son, went out to the hostel and talked to the refugees about painting. The Von Trapps came after a night concert at Cornell College. The next morning, they tootled down the road and sang for the refugees in their Austrian dirndl and lederhosen. So they tried as much as possible to expose the people to American culture, but not too much, not to overwhelm them.
And was there farming involved as well? Did the guests at the hostel also help to grow crops and take care of livestock?
Yes, there was actually a Quaker hostel in Cuba, Finca Seco Paso, and the idea was, as happened in the Dominican Republic and other places, that Jews fleeing Europe would no longer be bankers and professors and doctors and lawyers, but rather Jews would learn handicrafts and become farmers, which wasn't a very practical idea.
Although it feels a little more practical in
Iowa.
We're going to have to take a short break. I'm talking with historian Michael Lewig-Trams. He is the director of the Traces Center for History and Culture. He's the author of the book Out of Hitler's Reach and a guest lecturer at Cornell College. He'll be doing a number of presentations about the Quakers and the Holocaust, one at the Public Library in Grinnell on Sunday, March 31st, and one on April 6th at the Scattergood School in West Branch. You can find out about others on his website, traces.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about a small organization that welcomed refugees 80 years ago. In fact, the Scattergood Hostel opened 80 years ago this month. A group of Quakers decided they wanted to provide a place of shelter and a pathway to a new life for refugees who had fled Nazi violence and aggression in Europe. Over the time that the hostel was open in West Branch, it gave shelter to 185 refugees. It closed in 1943. With me, historian Michael Lewig-Trams. He is the director of the Traces Center for History and Culture and a guest lecturer at Cornell College. And I also want to bring into the conversation now one of the guests at the hostel, Edith Morgan Frayling. Then she was called Edith Lichtenstein. She was 11 years old when she arrived in Iowa, and she is with us on the line from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hello, Edith.
Hi, good morning to you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And first, tell me a little bit about your family. I realize you were 11 years old when you got to Iowa, so your early memories may be a little bit distant. But tell me about your family in Europe before the days of Hitler.
Well, we left Germany I was born in Limburg, Germany, and my father was a federal judge there. And my brother had just been born in March 1933 when we had to leave. The Germans had elected Hitler, and things were getting pretty bad. I won't go into all the details. I think you know the history, and Michael can speak to that a lot better than I can. But we had to flee. My father was not only Lundgericht taught a German judge, but he was also Jewish. My mother was a convert to Judaism, and in March 1933, my brother was just about to be born, and we were able to flee. They had already imprisoned my father, and he still had a few friends in high places, I guess. They let him out for a few days to take my mother on a little vacation for a few days because it was a difficult birth. But instead of vacationing, they took a suitcase and made it over the border into Switzerland. This was March 1933. And shortly, of course, thereafter, the Nazis took away our citizenship, so we're non-persons at that point. We stayed in Switzerland for a month, but with no money, no job, no connections, the Swiss advised us to cross the border into France and find the nearest policeman there and report as refugees, as basically what I guess they're calling illegal immigrants now. But that was happening a good deal in France at the time, I think. And so we ended up in Paris and lived there for, we lived in Paris and on the outskirts for about 6, 7.5 years. And then, of course, the Germans again occupied, and my mother and brother and I had to walk. We walked from Paris to Limoges and then into Le Puy to south central France, which was then the last part of France that was still free. But again, after a few months, we realized we had to get out. There's a lot of in between. I won't.
Right. But you walked.
We don't have time for that.
But you walked for 11 days in front of the army.
And yeah, we just barely kept in front of them all the time.
Wow.
But finally, an armistice was signed, and so we were in south central France, and we knew, again, we had to get out because it was just a matter of time because they would come for us there, too. So by great good luck, we had some the Swiss had a sort of a foster parent program where children of refugees were sent to vacation in various Swiss so-called foster homes every summer. And my brother and I went, and he lucked out and landed in the home of a family who became very, very attached to him and very fond of him. And to make a long story short, when we couldn't go and when we had no way out, they took their life savings out and they gave it to us to help us get out of France. And by sheer good luck, always at the last minute, it seems, we managed to get passage on a Portuguese freighter, of all things, that the Portuguese had captured in World War I from the Germans and had reconverted into a sort of a passenger ship. So it wasn't a luxury liner, but at least it was flying a neutral flag, so we had some chance of getting out of Europe. My parents explored. They wanted to go to Israel because at that time the British were supposed to have facilitated immigration from Europe into Israel, but they that was all messed up, and they were turning ships back and so on, so that was not a possibility anymore. So we managed to get into the United States when the quotas here were failed. I think Michael already alluded to some of the problems getting into the United States.
Right, thousands and thousands of people were turned away.
At that time, President Roosevelt at that time had created a special category called political refugees, and we were able to get in under that. And my mother always used to say at 5 minutes to 12, help will come. And I guess it did, because we got into the United States here on Labor Day, September 7th, 1941. And, of course, 2 months later, nobody got in anymore because it was Pearl Harbor and the United States went fully into the war. I am not absolutely sure how the Quakers got hold of us when we were in New York. We were in New York for about a month, and I remember being in school there and trying to learn English, but didn't learn much because everybody else knew German and French, and so I could manage on what I already knew. But when we came to when Okakers got us to Skatagooders, it was a total change in life entirely. And I think a part of the idea they had was, instead of establishing another refugee ghetto in New York, why not bring people into the heartland, you know, and create American citizens. And it was an excellent plan. As Michael pointed out, there were a lot of wonderful young people that we kept in touch with years later on. I think the last one I remember I kept in touch with was in ended up in Syracuse, Joyce DeLine Ball, who continued being an activist, as Michael pointed out, all the rest of her life. A person named Par Danforth is the one who took my family after 10 months at Skatagood and found us a place to live and found my father work and found us a sponsor in St. Paul, Minnesota. So we, after 10 months at Skatagood, we were transported to Minnesota, and we had a job and a place to live and some sponsors, and were able to survive.
So, Edith, can you, you had just turned 11 years old when you came to Iowa. Can you tell me what your first impression was? What is your first memory of arriving?
Well, it was the country. We were city folks. You know, all my life I remember living in either Paris or the outskirts of Paris or some French city. And I'd never been on the farm. We're not rural. And we're totally out. If you know where Skatagood was located at that time, the biggest place was West Branch nearby. And I'd never been on a farm. And, of course, Walter and Sarah Stanley, who were the old farm couple, had kind of looked like the couple in Grant Wood's Gothic painting there, the famous one. And and of course, although there were at Skatagood other people who spoke both German and French, by the time we went to school, we were sent to school in the school bus into the little school in West Branch. We were the only ones who couldn't speak English, and we learned English very rapidly, and it wasn't very difficult. But I had never taken the school bus to school, and I had to learn the American English very quickly. My father had a little less trouble learning it because they had studied some of the British English in Europe in the schools at that time already.
So,
a wonderful time, actually. It was a real free time because there were a number of us kids our age. And I remember running in the fields, and I think I captured my first field mouse, which bit me in the finger.
Oh.
After they had taken down this was in the fall, of course, and the cornfields had been, you know,
harvested.
Harvested, and so there was just the stalks there. And I picked up the little field mouse, and that was one of my more vivid memories. Because I was not accustomed to, the living animals in the city. You don't get one. I did have a pet turtle once in Paris, but that was as close as I got to any living animal.
It
was a wonderful experience for us kids, because we never had the kind of freedom to roam the countryside and that we had there. And, of course, everybody helped with everything. Everybody had a job. It was our first experience also in that kind of communal living. And I think it was my father's first experience at helping in the kitchen and wearing an apron, because you didn't do that over there. He didn't. My mother did all of that. That was women's work.
Right. So I have to ask you, Edith, during this time, of course, there was a lot of anti-German sentiment all over the United States. When you went to that school in West Branch, were the children welcoming or were they wary of you?
No, they seemed to be welcoming. After all, we were kind of a novelty, you know. I suppose if 100 or 200 kids had suddenly overwhelmed a school, that would have been one thing. But I don't recall anybody. Maybe they just didn't know. We were really eager to learn English, and, everybody was extremely helpful. The staff at Skatagood were wonderful. A lot of them, I think one was a history teacher, Bob Corian, taught American history. There was a lot of formal teaching going on, too, with the adults, with the parents. We got all our teaching at the school in West Branch. But they all had some kind of skill or some kind of background that they brought. I remember the Pembertons and the Copperthorns and all of the, and of course Joyce Ball. And my parents kept in touch for many years after we had left Scattergood with a lot of those people because, you know, we could exchange ideas and they were educated. And I think there was Peggy Hannum also, who later married and was Peggy Stevens, and I can remember years later them still being in touch with them. So these were not just young farm people. They were mostly the people we came in contact with and who were busy Americanizing us were actually, you know, well-educated. Right. And had a lot of information to share. And I think there was a mutual exchange, too. We shared our culture with them, and they shared their culture with us.
So I'm sure.
I think that a lot of the project, I don't think Michael mentioned that as much, but in looking back, I think we had the sense that the idea was to try to Americanize and make comfortable in the American culture, you know, the refugee families that were there, because otherwise, and you know, an awful lot of arriving refugees ended up in, I guess, what you might call ethnic ghettos and in the big cities.
Edith,
I think this was an experiment to see if we could possibly, if they could, you know, adapt incoming refugees to a less immigrant-populated area.
Edith, I don't want to in any way erode or negate your glowing tribute. I also experienced through my interviews and through the documents that Scattergood was a lovely thing. But it's interesting to comment about having never taken a school bus to school. The Des Moines Register once sent a journalist, in fact, a great mine for information for me from my book was old articles, which today would be very different. But in those days, the Des Moines Register, Iowa City Press, the Cedar Rapids Gazette spent relatively a lot of copy space exploring the events at Scattergood. And one day, a Des Moines Register reporter was on the front lawn at one of these English classes under a tree, and the school bus went by in the afternoon, and the kids shot down the windows and yelled out, "Hey, you German spies." So one of the things that I want to do in my 8 programs coming up this spring and early summer is to relevantize and say, yes, this is a great story. There's a lot of goodness that's incarnate in what happened there. There's also these undertones, and I think we should point out the end of the hostel, that at first the neighbors around Scattergood tolerated the Jewish and other refugees coming from Europe, but when the war was so intense and the Quakers couldn't get enough people to come to warrant keeping the hostel open for them, the Quakers suggested, well, you know, we have the physical plant, we have volunteers, and now we have actually a surplus of funds. Let's bring Japanese-American internees from the desert, let's bring them from the camps to Iowa. They can help farm. They can get jobs. And the neighbors resoundingly said, no, we don't want, quote, those nips here. It was a very different reaction. And so one of the stories that I intend to tell this speaking tour is, yes, Scattergood is this great model of what really can be done good in the world. And yet we being humans often succumb to our deepest demons, our prejudices, hate, seclusion, and this story needs to be told as well.
I am curious, during the time once the United States entered the war, the Quakers are pacifists. Was there tension about the Quakers not believing in fighting? And of course, the refugees, I can imagine many of them were very eager to see the United States in the war and fighting.
It would have been different for Mennonites, Quakers and Brethren across the Midwest, across the country. In West Branch, though, there was such a long Quaker tradition, plus so many Quakers, that I think that even the non-Quakers in the community knew that the Quakers, the Quaker neighbors were genuine pacifist, and I think there was some slack cut. However, we also know that when this FBI agent came out with his wife from Chicago to look at the hostel and to see whether it'd be a place to bring Japanese-American internees, people testified, and you could read in the accounts this sort of ambivalent resentment well, you Quakers, you know, you're going to be exempt from this war again. So it was mixed. It was really mixed.
Interesting. Well, Edith, thank you so much for sharing your story. And I'm so glad you have such good memories. And your family was truly helped by this experience. Thank you, Edith.
Oh, absolutely. They were. Yes. Thank you for asking me.
Edith Morgan Frayling. She was Edith Lichtenstein when she arrived in Iowa as an 11-year-old back in 1940. She was with us on the line from Worcester, Massachusetts. And Michael, I know that you're going to be doing a number of programs about this period in history. You're going to be at the Grinnell Library on Sunday, March 31st at 2:30. You'll be doing a program at the Scattergood School in West Branch on April 6th. And you have all of your programs at traces.org. But what do you think the most important thing is for Iowans to know about this episode in just 30 seconds?
That ordinary people can make a great difference, and it's extraordinary the results they can achieve together.
Michael, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Michael Lewick Trams is a historian. He is the director of the Traces Center for History and Culture and author of the book Out of Hitler's Reach. We've been talking about the 80th anniversary of the opening of the Scattergood Friends Hostel in West Branch, which gave shelter to 185 refugees as it operated from 1939 to 1943. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.